Hello.
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 What's going on?
Not a mucho, as they say. Mm.
Well, that's what you say. Yes. Nobody else says that.
No. So busy, Dan. It's all just, it's so busy. Did you know that we live in an era of peak TV where anyone can watch a television show whenever they want to watch it, and there's so many that they'll probably never see all of them?
It's the golden age, they say.
Yeah. It's,
I mean,
privilege.
You can watch anything you want, but you know, everyone that we know on the internet is watching Letterkenny right now.
I have not caught up with that infatuation at the moment. It's something I've been meaning to get to. I don't know if you are aware of this, but there is a podcast on The Incomparable called TV Talk Machine, and it's with one of the TV critics from The Hollywood Reporter. Sorry, I think it's chief TV critic of The Hollywood Reporter, Tim Goodman, and he has been talking about Letterkenny for years. he thinks it's fantastic and it's underrated and nobody talks about it. And I know Merlin listens to that show. And so he's talking about it now because he finally got around to it. And now everybody got around to it.
Yeah. It's noticeable, Merlin's influence from time to time because he has a lot of followers. And, you see a lot of ancillary tweets that are because of that. But, Yeah, I've been familiar with Letterkenny for a long time.
If Merlin jumped off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge?
It's a good question. Would Simon Pegg be there to catch me with a robot?
Would you have a tiny wire to protect you from falling 100 stories?
I always wear a little chainmail suit under my clothes. What are you talking about?
No, I was talking about the stunt wire that Tom Cruise wears when he's climbing on the building, the real building.
Oh. I mean, yeah, I would prefer a stunt wire, sure.
to chainmail?
Or both, you know, just for safety's sake.
Yeah. So speaking of wires and chainmail, and not Letterkenny, because it's nothing really to do with that at all. It's more of an Ontario thing, and this is more of a Vancouver/Dubai thing, and Prague. And we've got... Mission Impossible 4, which no one wanted to call Mission Impossible 4, apparently, and it's called Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. But let me read this to you in the style in which I am accustomed. Mission, colon, space, impossible, space, M-dash, ghost, space, protocol. It is not beautiful to look at when you are looking at it as plain text.
I'm not even sure that's an M-dash.
Is it just a hyphen?
Well, okay. Wikipedia has an M-dash. IMDb just has a hyphen, but that's bad.
Okay, yeah. See, that's the thing. Is like I find conflicting sources. I'm looking at Wikipedia right now, which, as we know, is a source of truth, undisputed truth. So it's just one of those weird things where it's just like they knew they couldn't do another colon. Because that would be weird. But
Mission
they,
colon impossible colon ghost protocol.
Yeah, it's too many colons. You can't have double colons.
I mean, you probably can, but it comes with some extra complications.
Well, I mean, that's more of a human centipede kind of scenario than, you know, a title scenario. Because your colon is your large intestine. Not the small intestine. Just the large one. Evening too.
Today we learned something, kids.
Yeah, it's also two dots. But how about that? Two dots, but it's one colon. Two dots, one colon. Anyway, I'm
two
a little loopy.
Two is one, is what they say.
Well, I was thinking of another thing that has two and one, but
yeah, no, let's.
Yeah, I'm not gonna. Yeah. No,
listeners, if you can't tell, we're very tired.
Oh God, I'm so tired
for all of these things.
Yeah. But anyway, I would like
to. By the way, there's no dash or second colon in the posters.
Yeah, well, that's because it's a poster.
Well, I mean, there's the first colon, but no second colon or dash.
Yeah, but they can style it however they want to on a poster. Is my point. You can't just like hit. New line and, you know, have your Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
There's no carriage returns in baseball or IMDb websites.
There's no carriage returns in movie titles. But this is a movie that when we had started this series, I said I had not seen. Many people have spoken highly of this movie, and I was like, sure, but I kind of don't want to watch it because I soured on Mission Impossible after the second one, and I don't particularly like Tom Cruise as like a person or like in movies. But I was just like, okay, fine. Fine, Dan, you wore me down. We'll do all the Mission Impossible movies. Whatever you want.
Victorious.
You could have had anything you wanted, and you wished for this.
I was right all along.
Well, that's not exactly how I would have phrased it. I would have said, I don't regret watching this movie. I liked it a lot. I think of the four we have watched, this is my favorite so far.
I concur.
Okay, good.
I mean, the first one still, you know, holds a special place in our hearts, but this is a good movie.
Well, the first one has several flaws that I had enumerated before. The first ones obviously weren't deal breakers for me to keep on going on with watching the second one, but I didn't like that it didn't feel like a team working together. He assembles some people, but he's really like the character, and then everybody else is just kind of there. I didn't like the plot machinations and the betrayal thing that was going on. It was all too twisty and weird and convoluted. I love the set pieces. I love the way that De Palma does tension. I thought that was all very interesting. The second movie suffered from bad writing. Very bad. Awful, really. Trying to make it into more of like a Pierce Brosnan late 90s Bond kind of a thing. It didn't work as a team. Everything was still convoluted and weird. Stuff just kind of happened, and it was shot by John Woo, directed by John Woo. So there were a lot of shots where you're just like, why is there a slow motion flamenco dancer keyed and then composited in front of them in both of these shots? Why are there birds? But that's neither here nor there. Cause then we got to the third one, and in the third one, J.J. Abrams said, quick, look over there, keep running. And then
pretty reboot. Make it dark and green.
Yeah, and just keep going, just keep going, don't stop. Tension comes from continuous motion.
Get a haircut, hippie, go get married.
Yeah. And so while the third one I felt bounced back a little from the second, I didn't love it. It still lacked teamwork, and it still relied on traitors and like convoluted, you know, oh well, you thought I was on this side, but I'm actually on this side, and it's like, well,
and so many masks.
Yeah,
all of the movies had lots and lots of masks.
So many masks. Does three have the most masks?
I think two actually has the most masks. Now that I think about it, three just has your Philip Seymour Hoffman mask,
mm-hmm.
which is a very impressive mask.
Well, it has a really good shot. I really do love the shot of Philip Seymour Hoffman washing his hands, and then he leans up and there's the Philip Seymour Hoffman behind him, and the camera moves around, and then you see Ving Rhames there in the corner and all the other stuff. It's a good shot.
I gotta tell you, I would be incredibly unsettled if I stood up from washing my hands and Philip Seymour Hoffman was just leering behind me.
Well, I mean, for many reasons, mostly he's
for
dead.
For many, many reasons.
Unfortunately, he's dead. The fourth one is completely different. I like that it does things differently. And again, I'm going to highlight the Light the Fuse podcast, which we had mentioned previously in our outings. Since neither you nor I are Mission Impossible experts, mission heads, Impossa fans, we don't have like the full depth of knowledge about this stuff. So I found it actually pretty insightful to tune into their podcasts where they had Paul Hirsch on, and he talked about editing for the first movie and editing for Ghost Protocol, and for Todd Fasiri, who was just on, and he talked about three and four. And then there was also Brad Bird, which I went back and listened to right before we recorded. He was on there for a 3-part series where they kept trying to wrap the interview, and he said, "No, I have more to tell you." And he seems like an interesting guy. I would really like to meet Brad Bird. He might not be the most pleasant person to work with on set if you can't achieve the vision that he's out for, but which he seems freely to be the first to admit. But it was a really interesting interview with him where he walks through a lot of his thought processes and stuff. And one of them is that he felt like there was an over-reliance on masks, and he wanted to have a team that felt like more of a team, that it wasn't just Tom being kind of a loner. And he wanted to have a return to the TV title sequence where you see bits of things that haven't happened yet in the opening titles. And he wanted to sort of pull in some of those sorts of things. And also he wanted to have all of the miraculous technology that they use fail, so all the stuff breaks every time they use it, which is really interesting when you compare it to the first 3 movies, where everything, all the devices that they use work basically flawlessly, and they're all very intricate and highly detailed to certain purposes. So it really gave this movie a different flavor. It doesn't feel like the first in a series. I don't think you could start with Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol and be like, "There we go, we're there." Especially when
everything's broken and we've all been disavowed.
Yeah, especially when you're dealing with the references to the third movie, because they do mention at several points his wife, and they do have a very brief cameo of Ving Rhames at the end, and a very brief cameo of Michelle Monaghan at the end, which is odd, an odd beat, but it's a pretty interesting movie. And he also wanted to have humor and not crack him up, laugh him up humor. But he wanted to have humor like Die Hard or something like that, where there was something that gave it a little more pizzazz, but didn't make it feel like it was a Austin Powers, you know? So I felt like that kind of worked, you know, you got a sense of that. Especially when you're dealing with these devices that are malfunctioning, that gives you some comedy.
Plus, you throw Benji in there doing silly stuff, like when he stands up and sticks his face in front of the camera on the silver screen gag. That's pretty great.
Yeah. And, it lightens the mood, keeps things going, but it's not super cheese ball nonsense. And you also got Brad Bird's sensibility when it comes to the visuals, what he wants to see, what he wants to have occur in terms of the approach that he has in composing a shot, or the motion that he wants to see occur. Like he wants, you know, this mark, and they run from there to there, and the camera follows on this, and if the wind blows the camera out of the way, they got to redo the whole thing. Like he has a very particular mindset when it comes to approaching this stuff, and I found that to be really interesting to hear his side of things. Paul Hirsch also says he kind of focuses too much on the details and doesn't focus on the big picture. And that
that's
the one time
there were a couple of shots, flyover shots on their way into Dubai where the camera was a little shaky, where I was like, why didn't you stabilize that? I would have stabilized that. Maybe that's one of the ones that Paul Hirsch fast forwarded over.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they gave it to Todd, and Todd's like, you know, I don't want to filter this too much, and he only did it like a little bit, hand keyed it to give it a little camera shake.
Fair enough.
Yeah, you wanted to have some natural camera shake.
Did
Academy
of
Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Todd Vizieri, who was the comp supervisor on this?
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Couple things. First thing, is it me, or does Brad Bird kind of look like Charles Grodin's cousin? It's rhetorical. Second of all, in the podcast, since I haven't listened to it yet, did he talk about the reshoots at the end of the movie?
Yeah, he does mention that they shot an ending he wasn't entirely happy with, just as Tom Cruise convinced him to do, to have it in the can, but he felt like it was a really weird pep talk that didn't work, and so he wanted to reshoot it, even though it tested well. And so they, like, apparently shot on some abandoned warehouse where they assembled like half a background and put some stuff together in order to do a couple fill-in things to make it all make a little more sense than it did originally.
But the ending scene was still mostly them sitting around a table at the end there and him saying hi to his wife or whatever through the door.
Well, he doesn't say hi to his wife. He looks at her across.
Oh, he waved.
There's a meaningful glance, yeah. The difference is that originally she doesn't see him, and they change that to be that she turns and looks at him, and so there's an acknowledgement that he's there. He felt it was too cold the way they were going to end it before. And because apparently part of the original ending was that he gives some pep talk about how they're on a team together and there's no time for love, no time for love, Dr. Jones or whatever. But it was a weird, he said, because it didn't feel like it ended on the right note where you answered all the questions of the movie and you felt like things were complete, especially the stuff with Jeremy Renner's character. He felt like there didn't need to be a beat to have them talk.
I can see that there could be a version where he doesn't admit to Jeremy Renner that she's still alive, and then he just kind of like looks on and she doesn't see, like, you know, he's keeping the secret to himself. Like, I could see that being a version that they would want to shoot, but it's a little more satisfying to have him say, like, you're part of the team now, let's get on the secret or whatever.
Yeah.
And you can definitely tell that that scene is the reshot scene because all the bokeh's wrong.
Yeah. Well, there was something funny he was saying in there where it was just like, we had all these buildings on the other side of Vancouver that were all lit up with these lights, but obviously we couldn't do that, so for the background we took some like foam core and covered it in gaffer's tape and put it slightly out of focus.
Stick some Christmas lights over there, you get some big large bokeh shapes, except they're spherical instead of anamorphic, and they intercut with the other stuff, and Tom Cruise's hair is it looks like he took a wig that looked like his hair from the rest of the movie and then put it over top of his long hair, so he has like doubly long hair. It's close, but it's not, whatever, some time has passed, maybe. Well, no, Fingrames is like, I've been digging a missile out of the bay for a week, so it's been like a week later and his hair is very long.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever, it's fine.
Yeah,
it's not distracting at all. neither is the fact that they all have iPhone 4s with the headphone jack on the top, which is weird.
That was pretty funny, especially when you see, I think there's a shot of iOS 6 somewhere earlier in the movie. iOS 6
yeah,
or
where
5.
He gets the text from the blocked number. It says, like, I'm ready or I'm here or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Scott Forstall's vision is just embedded in this movie forever.
Yeah, mission skeuomorphic. So, all in all, like, to start off with a summary, I do really like this movie. And I thought that this was the best of the four. My favorite scene in a Mission Impossible movie is still the breaking into the CIA scene, suspending from the ceiling stuff from the first movie. But there's so much more that I don't like about that movie. And there's a lot more that I do like about this one. So I would say it has a higher, like, medium level of goodness about this one.
It's more evenly cooked.
Yes, it's much more evenly cooked. And the thing that I really do enjoy, I think, that sets it apart from the other three is the teamwork, the aforementioned teamwork. That helps a lot, because otherwise you just get sort of a brooding Ethan Hunt thing like we've had in the previous three movies, where he's just sort of scowling about stuff and shouting at people to, like, fly him places and give him equipment and open a door or something over a radio. So it's much more fun to see him interact with other people and to rely on those other people to perform tasks, so that it's not just him doing everything. We didn't really get much of that in the third movie. We got a little more than we got in the first or second, you know, because Ving Rhames was scuba diving into the Vatican in that one. The other agent who drove in the Lamborghini, she had some things that she did, and there was a brief bit of dialogue between her and the other guy, and that was it. No more of them.
Yeah, they're gone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they had the helicopter pilot guy, and they had the lady in their team, so they kept that.
Mm-hmm. No, but
you enjoyed the team. You enjoyed the humor. How did you enjoy the action on the whole?
I thought it was shot very well. Everything made sense. It was all very clear what was happening. do you disagree?
No, it's just a pretty low bar for satisfaction.
No, I mean, that might sound like I'm damning it with faint praise of like, you've met expectations for filming an action sequence, but it is surprisingly difficult to do given the intricacy of the action sequences that they were going for, especially when you get to something like the garage fight at the end. I can't figure out how I would shoot that, like, in my head. If you told me that there are two guys who are going to fight bouncing from thing to thing in a robot car garage, flinging a suitcase around, like, I just don't think I could piece it together quite like they did in the movie. I think it works really well.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of incredible. I've seen this movie many, many times, and it's very memorable. I remember lots of the movie. Some of the things that I don't remember super well, probably because I'm exhausted too, is just I started watching it. I was like, oh yeah, how does this movie start again? I kind of forget. And you're like, oh right, it's the fella from Lost with the hair doing the thing where he jumps off the building and he's got his little air mattress that pops up beneath him in that very short scene, which I guess, whatever, that was in, I believe, one of the Todd casts where they said it was much longer, but they cut it down because it wasn't working. But that and then the prison break, which where we meet Bogdan, which is, you know, also a fun scene. But like, I completely forget about those things because they're just so utterly overshadowed by the Burge stuff and the flying Jeremy Renner through the server with magnets kind of stuff and the car park fight at the end. There's so many huge crazy set pieces that are super cool in this movie.
Yeah, I have to say that a criticism I would have is maybe that the beginning, while it throws you into it and it's interesting, when you zoom out and look at the whole movie, it is kind of forgettable in like the grand scheme of things, exactly what's going on there.
Yeah. I mean, you got to set the stage for the plot, and you know, they're trying to get into this Mission Impossible, like dramatic cold open kind of thing. And they went with one that didn't actually involve Ethan, which is an interesting attempt. And it's just, you get what happened and you're introduced to a couple of the characters, but, It is kind of forgettable. I mean, it's nice to see their plan or whatever and the way they're going through things, and they're also having their own difficulties with the technology and stuff, but it's another one of those things where just, again, this entire movie, like the other movies, there's no downtime between any of these major set pieces for the people in movie time. It's like, all right, get to the Kremlin. You've got 4 hours till he gets there, basically. And it's like they break him out of the prison as soon as they realize that these are the people they need to go get. And then they're flying to India as soon as they know that the satellite's there. And it's just like relentless. But it all works for the goals of this spy team.
Yeah, there is a weird brief bit of downtime after the failure of the mission at Burj Khalifa, where they're regrouping sort of in whatever strange little house they found to regroup in. And that is a little weird because it's entirely used for Jeremy Renner to relay a story that explains how Jeremy Renner is an agent and also the Tom Cruise, the Ethan Hunt angle on it and how that has to tie back to the imprisonment part and the wife thing. And so it's, that got a little weird in that one part in the downtime, where I wish that had maybe kind of like been smoothed out a little with an iron, but,
it does get a little, Jeremy Renner does, you know, sit the kids down and give them a talk, kind of, a lengthy conversation about telling his story. But you know, I think they intercut it well with him, you know, making his way around town, on his way to go meet the tall blonde man from Mission Impossible 1 again. I told you he would come back. Did you notice him?
Yes, I definitely noticed him and the mask.
And the mask, yes.
And I was a little disappointed that the arm sealer was not Vanessa Redgrave.
Or at the very least, like he could have gotten a text from Max saying like, good luck with your whatever.
Yeah. Well, apparently, Paramount, being infamously very cheap, did not want to pay Vanessa Redgrave what Vanessa Redgrave is owed to perform, which is a mistake. And so it went to, they created this character of The Fog, which is apparently that guy's name, I guess. Mm. who is this other arms dealer. It works fine because it would have maybe been a little bit of a stretch to have Max out of prison and back doing her arms dealing and working with Ethan Hunt, who had previously betrayed her.
She didn't go to prison. She cut a deal with Kittredge.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it still would have been weird that she would agree to work with Ethan Hunt or trust him. But
I think part of the benefit in that scene is that he's creating a new relationship with this person, and it's a give and take that's useful in the plot.
Yeah. Another thing that apparently impacted this movie was that Paramount's cheapness meant that they didn't have really any time for location scouting or to set things up and get things in motion, because they were negotiating with Tom Cruise and wouldn't agree to let Brad Bird get started on making the movie because they were negotiating so heavily, playing hardball with Tom Cruise. So maybe, I think the moral of the story is that Paramount shouldn't be cheap. That's awfully hard for them not to do, since they continue their race towards the bottom by slashing and cutting away things and making deals with people to finance things so they don't have to absorb any risk, but then not making any money because they don't make any revenue on those things. But whatever.
This is still a fairly costly movie, also given that there was a lot of, there was IMAX material in here as well, so.
Yeah, the Burj Khalifa stuff. Yeah, the Burj Khalifa stuff was all, was IMAX and helicopter IMAX, which apparently you can shoot for like 3 minutes, I think Brad Bird said, before you have to go land your helicopter and get a new loaded IMAX camera onto it and then fly that up. You couldn't reload it on the helicopter.
Three minutes is kind of a lot of footage.
Well, not if you need to start rolling and wait for things to be all lined up, because they'd also need to make sure that the helicopter was going to get the right angle on Tom Cruise climbing up a building. So apparently it was tricky, but it took him a couple days to get that all sorted. I think it's worth it.
Definitely worth it.
Obviously I'm watching it on a plasma screen TV, which is 16:9 and does not have the all-encompassing IMAX wall of viewing that I would have had I gone to go see this in a theater, which is lamentable. It's pretty interesting. I think the shots they got were pretty good. You're looking at a guy who is climbing up a building, and he's doing that with just a tiny little wire to keep him from falling to his death, and that's it. No nets or, you know, inflatable things below him, no second wires, no crew standing by. Like, if that had snapped or come uncoupled or anything, then there would be no Tom Cruise. Which is,
and of course, classically, the insurance was like, should we try and do some other stuff to protect him? And they're like, I mean, at this height, something goes wrong, he's dying. Like, there's nothing else we can do, so just don't screw up.
Yeah, there was a funny thing that Brad Bird was talking to the stunt coordinator, I think he said, where he asked the stunt coordinator about this, and he's like, oh yeah, well, you know, you fall from 3 floors, then it's fatal. So you're like, what's the difference? You just got longer to think about it on your way down. It's just like, wow.
Yeah. Anything above 3, it's like, you know, whatever. It's like the old bomb squad joke. It's like, is it stressful defusing a bomb? It's like, not really. You're either right, or it's suddenly not your problem anymore.
Yeah. It's just weird to think about that. And apparently, despite all of their effort, a lot of people still, you know, think that a lot of that was green screen, etc., CGI. It was just mostly paintwork for removing the wire.
Good paintwork, and probably very difficult paintwork with all the reflective bits and stuff there. But the effect of the whole thing, I told you in the Slack, I've seen this movie many times over the years, and it still makes me incredibly nervous watching him climb on the outside of that building, even though I know the gecko gloves are fake or whatever, but just like trying to imagine what that would be like, it makes my palms sweaty and it makes me uncomfortable. And I'm like, Oh, he's kicking the glass. Is he going to make, like, I know he makes it through. I know he's not going to die. I've seen this movie so many times. And also, it's a movie starring Tom Cruise. He's going to survive and he's going to do good stuff. But it's like, man, the suspense in that is so good. It just, it gets me every time.
It's very good. I thought they did a good job. And it doesn't resort to, like, there's no, like, quick cutting or, like, real crunchy dark so you can't tell what's happening and something could come around a corner. It's like, no, you're there on the side of a building. It's very bright. And you're looking at Tom Cruise climbing up reflections all over the side of this building in real time. Like, it's just crazy. Like, there's
an opening shot where the crane pushes out and goes over his head and then spins around, like, as he comes out of the building. Like, that's, you see Tom Cruise and you see him stepping out of a building onto the side little rail there. It's like, oh God.
Yeah. And there's also an interesting shot, where, you see the sandstorm in the distance. And so you see Tom Cruise look at the sandstorm in the reflection, and then the camera rotates around where the camera would be through the glass if it had been there. It's an interesting way to compose that shot. I like that one. I like how they seed the tension from having this sandstorm that, don't worry about it, it's far away. It's not going to be our problem because we're going to be done by the time it gets here. And it's like, well, yes, except it isn't. But, you know, Chekhov's sandstorm, it's nice that they seed that there. So it doesn't just feel like they suddenly run up into the streets and there's a sandstorm, which would have been strange. But,
yeah, as somebody who, lives in a place where sandstorms like that happen, you can definitely see them coming for a while before they get there.
Have you been in one as dense as, Tom Cruise and, what's his face?
Yeah, they're that dense, in real life. They're not usually as windy and, like, blowing sand and rocks and grit into your face. It's just suddenly there's a fog of dirt everywhere and you can't see, or you don't really want to breathe or go outside and stuff. But yeah, they're bad. You can't see where you're going if you're stuck in it.
No, that's unfortunate.
take a nap.
Yeah, well, in Florida, we would get, torrential downpours, where you could not see, like, it was impossible. Like, you couldn't see, like, feet in front of your car. So you'd just stop your car, pull over to the side, and wait, because it was completely unsafe to drive anywhere because there's just too much rain. It's just like, would be like driving, even if you turn on your lights, nothing, you wouldn't see a thing. It's crazy.
Yeah, I've been in that once or twice, and that is some scary stuff. It's also kind of cool because rain's cool.
Yeah, well, it's cool until it kills you.
The trick is just don't die.
Yes. Man, remember that in the climate change apocalypse. But so anyway, let's briefly summarize this movie. It opens with an agent who is not Ethan Hunt, who is defeating some guys, jumping off the thing into an inflatable air mattress, rolling off. Then his phone rings and he gets shot and killed. And the phone reveals that it was an assassin, because it says assassin. And then we go to rescue Ethan Hunt from the Moscow prison that he's in. And he gets collected basically by Simon Pegg, who we recognized from the previous movie, and Paula mm-hmm. Patton. They're working to free him, according to some plan we're not privy to, where Simon Pegg gets access to the prison systems and he's opening doors and playing music. Dean Martin,
yeah,
specifically.
Do a little bit of a Hudson Hawk with some Dean Martin, which is a good track.
Yeah, and then they start releasing prisoners first in order to cause a distraction. Then they finally release Tom Cruise, and he had been throwing what I thought was a rubber ball against the wall, and it turns out it was a tiny, tiny little piece of plaster that he had been playing with. And so he puts that back into the plaster wall thing, or rock or whatever. It had been rounded from all of his flinging. And
he definitely did that for real, and that was definitely not a CG rock bouncing off the wall.
No, you know, it was super real. Sorry, Todd, cover your ears. But he gets out into the prison, and he instead of leaving, He motions over the thing to go back and do a thing. And so reluctantly, Simon Pegg pushes the buttons to go do it. And because they're not talking, they can't communicate. He just has to do it based on hand gestures that Ethan Hunt has on security camera footage. Ethan Hunt goes back and gets this other guy who seems inept. And then they get through the sort of gauntlet of prisoners and guards to get to the extraction point. The floor blows up from some sort of blue plasma vortex thing, and then they go down via a cable to the lower level where Paula Patton is there, and she's confused about this other guy, and he says, "Don't worry about it." And they get in a van, and
he also says, "Who are you? And why are you here? And what's going on?" And she's like, "What? I thought you would know." He's like, "No, I was in prison up there playing with my rock. So what's going on?"
Yeah. And so they in the van, he sees Simon Pegg, and he's talking to Paula Patton. Paula Patton's checking his identity to make sure he's real and not just some guy with a mask, because that's the kind of thing you need to do. And then they offload the prison guy to another van, and they...
I love the way he darts him, and the just that, oh, noise he makes, and then he goes, "My friend," as he passes out and falls out of the back of the van.
Yeah, and apparently... that was something where they were trying to come up with something that would work to replace a sequence that they had originally wanted to do. Stuff wasn't really working out, and they rewrote the whole thing. And they got these guys, and sort of they were people that Brad Bird kind of had a vague impression of based on the casting process from Prague, I guess. And so he remembered two people. One of them, I think, was a security guard, and then the other one was this guy, and so they ended up being cast for these sort of extended roles of stuff happening. But they have a mission where they got to go to Moscow to get the information about this guy who stole the thing from the stuff and the whatever.
is a crazy Russian nuclear, I want to blow the world up kind of guy. And they're not entirely sure who he is, but he was Russian intelligence, so they're supposed to go steal his codename dossier so they can figure out who he is and stop him so he doesn't blow people up. And then, you know, in the process, there's fun toys and jokes and stuff. I mean, I don't know how deep you want to talk about all of this stuff. You got the Tom Cruise wears a nose and a mustache, and Simon Pegg says that they should be wearing masks because that'd be fun, and everybody gets to wear a mask except Benji, and that would be cool. And he's very nervous because he's out in the field with Ethan Hunt, you know, the famous Ethan Hunt, who's been doing this for, 25 years or something at this point. But, you know, they do that same thing that they do in all of the movies, and they will continue to do, where they, like, hack the ID system and they immediately upload a false identity at the same time. They did it in the first movie, they did it in this movie. They're going to do it again in some other movies. They pretend to be a Russian general to sneak in.
Spoiler alert.
Well, I'm not going to tell you when or where. I mean, actually,
it's two movies, Dan.
No, it's one of the plot points. They're like, here's what we got to do. We got to break in, or we got to put a false ID into the thing.
I'm oh,
like,
boy.
All right, whatever. And then we get one of the cooler technology set pieces, which is the projection screen that pops out that tracks the guard's eyes and reprojects the backside of the room. So they can slide the little screen forward and sneak up and get into the vault. And it's a very cool piece of technology. It's very kind of silly, but it has flaws or whatever, particularly in that Benji sticks his face in front of the camera and they keep sliding it forward. And they're using that little clicker guy to make water drip sounds to sort of distract him. So they're not just relying on the one trick. You know, you're doing a couple different techniques to weasel your way up to the vault at the same time. But it was cool. And I liked that little thing. What did you think of the thing?
I thought it was interesting. It was, I will say, it was a little, like, goofy at first, because it's very flimsy, and the fact that you just drop an iPad in it seems a little silly, but it was nice how the movie communicated to you the way it functioned without having to have a character explain how it worked. And what I especially liked is when it malfunctions, that's how you know the way it functions. So when the other security guards start piling in there and it tries to eye track all of them and you see it flipping perspectives at the end of the hallway, that's the really good part that I enjoy about that particular.
I was going to say, as a visual effects boy, did that intrigue you because you understand the perspective projection kind of thing?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, you can project something so it looks right from a camera at a certain angle, but then, like, you move the camera too far off axis and it's not going to work. And then you have a bunch of different cameras, basically. You have a bunch of different eyes in a room, and you can't match that projection to everything. So it, like, freaks out, and it's just bouncing the end of the hall around, which I thought just it communicated it well, and the reason why it doesn't work for that reason, and how it had originally worked, and how the other guy had been fooled, because there's only one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so, but anyway, there's the bad guy, Cobalt, is in... It's such a so silly. I gotta say, the one
Chevy Cobalt.
One of that's very funny, Dan. But the one of the major complaints I have against this movie is that the bad guy is not compelling at all. You had mentioned previously that it was your a Russian scientist guy who he's not even Russian, he's Swedish, who wants to blow up the world. It's just one of those things where it was just like, how does he have the money to blow up the world? How does he have people who will blow up the world for him? Like, I don't understand how all of this works. How does he know the frequency that they're going to operate on to extract the thing in when they go down in here?
He used to work for a government agency, but it is a fair point to say, like, usually there's some form of profit involved, whereas this guy's kind of just like, if we destroy everyone equally, then the human race will flourish. It's kind of like that reverse of the to save the earth, we must kill all the humans kind of thing. Well, it's actually about the same
thing. Well, it's the same thing he says, like, in his like tirade video that they have.
Right, except he's not trying to do it to save the planet from, like, global warming caused by humans. He's just saying, like, there's too many people, and the next iteration of humanity is going to be pretty great if we just destroy a lot of people, because, you know, we'll be forced to rise up and stuff. Although... you know, you're just missing that part where you're like, and you get what out of this? Yeah. And how are you going to profit or just do anything afterward?
I mean, I don't have any objection to him lacking a firm grasp on his post-apocalypse plans. What I do have a problem with is just like his lackeys, how they go along with all of this, because that seems like the kind of thing where if you're hiring people to do a job, you're paying them in money that will soon not be worth anything. So what is really your thing that you're offering to those people? It's sort of like, in Kingsman, the first one, where it's like the advantage is you get to not have your head blow up and you get to not die like anywhere else because you're here in the safe place and stuff. But that's not really what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't really give a clear, like, reason why anybody would be doing any of this stuff for this bad guy. So it seems a little strange.
He's an anarchist, and he found some people who are followers of
loyal anarchists, the huge faction of them.
Yeah. Yeah, but
they're very strict adherence to anarchy.
Exactly. You know, there's a rule book. Well, there's a cookbook. I don't know if there's a rule book. I don't have a copy of it.
To serve man. But so anyway, they cross paths with this guy. I like that Ethan Hunt doesn't immediately recognize, hello, this is a bad guy. But yeah. I like that there's something suspicious about
him. Did
you also
notice that he was there when they were doing their ID scan, when he was pretending to be general guy and, like, threatening the other guy? Cobalt was, like, you know, 10 footsteps in front of them, and then there's another shot where he's, like, 30 footsteps in front of them, but they're, like, there at the exact same time.
Nope, I did not notice that because I hadn't seen him prior to watching this movie. So,
you can watch it again. You'll notice him sort of walking very briskly, looking at a cell phone just slightly in front of them.
Yeah. But anyway, he has the radio frequency, so he's able to sabotage things by talking on their radio frequency, which alerts the security guards who I guess are monitoring their radio frequency. It doesn't make any sense. But... he says all this stuff about team leader, blah, 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 in English, that they're going to go do this thing. And so the stuff blows up because he sabotages things. Benji and Tom Cruise split different paths. And Tom Cruise gets out of there just before it explodes, but he does this cool thing where he switches out his uniform, rips off the red stripes, and then flips the jacket inside out, and then he's got a Bruce Springsteen t-shirt on. Mm-hmm. So that was a really good use of the disguise stuff where it's not a mask. It is just clever stitching.
Yeah, he just yanks all the stuff off of his face. And then it's pretty great that he puts on a pair of glasses about 4 seconds before it's not an aftershock, it's a pre-shock or whatever, like jostles him and his glasses fall off of his face.
Yeah. And then we see the Kremlin explode, or really CG facsimile of the Kremlin explode. Tom Cruise is knocked over.
A very good shot done by a very good visual effects person.
Yes.
But he gets caught. He gets blowed up. He gets fired through the air. And then he wakes up. I really like the way he wakes up in the hospital. And he's like hearing the TV and all the subtitles are in Russian. And it takes him a minute before he can sort of like audibly translate them because he's all shooken up. But then the subtitles slowly turn into English, so we can sort of tell that he's eventually able to grasp what's happening around him.
Yeah, and he notices that he's cufflinked. Not cufflinked. That would be wrong. He's
handcuffed.
He's handcuffed to the gurney, and in walks the Russian counterintelligence cop guy. I forget his actual like title, but he's
called Sidorov.
Introduces himself to Ethan Hunt and says that he's busted and that he blew up the Kremlin and they're going to take him away. And Ethan Hunt's like, I didn't do it. We're on the same side. And he's like, you totally blew it up. And
he tries to light up a cigarette and the nurse snatches it out of his mouth and says, what are you doing? This is a hospital.
Yeah, which is a nice bit of flavor. But that allows Ethan the opportunity to grab a paperclip. And I like when the nurse goes to pick up the papers later and they all fall over the floor. It's like, yes, you don't have a paperclip. Ethan Hunt uses the paperclip to get out of the handcuffs and get onto the side of the building, where he doesn't apparently have a plan to get off the side of the building. So Sidorov is like, so you should just come back inside now. And Ethan Hunt is going to come back inside until he sees a truck coming by. And then he's like, aha, I have a belt. And so he takes off his belt and he puts it on what I guess is an electrical wire or a phone wire off the side of the building, slides down that onto the top of the truck, impacts, then rolls off and onto the ground and rolls some more. And then he limps out of there and confiscates a jacket and some shoes and then a cell phone. I like his very swift pickpocketing montage. And he calls the travel agency and tells them the secret code word to get a retrieval. And when he does that,
Alpha 113,
yeah, which is the Cal Arts classroom thingy for the animation thing. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's just the thing that they put in all the movies.
Yeah, well, the reason why they do it is because Brad Bird went to Cal Arts. But he goes to the pickup point and he's picked up by the head of the State Department, the Secretary of State, who's played by actor guy.
Secretary of the IMF.
Oh.
The head of the IMF is referred to as the Secretary.
IMF Secretary?
Yes. You'll want to remember that going forward because it becomes another person the sixth round.
So, in the previous movie,
yes,
there was an IMF secretary.
I don't know if we're dealing with one level below the secretary, but there is a secretary who's in charge of the IMF.
That seems weird. So anyway, the IMF secretary is Tom Wilkinson.
Secretary, what would you call him? Secretary of Forces?
Well, or missions? No, I just
Secretary of Impossibles.
Impossible
mission.
It doesn't. It doesn't seem like you could have a cabinet secretary with this particular title, is all I'm saying. I think that he would be the Secretary of State or somebody who would report to the Secretary of State. but I guess it's IMF secretary, which makes no sense. Whatever.
Well, it's a thing.
Yeah. So he's
the head of the IMF, and he's like, serious business here because the head fellow's here. And then also Jeremy Renner is here. He's an analyst.
Yeah. But for some reason, he's the public face of the IMF. Like, he was at an opening of a thing, but now, like, they're denying that he was there. And it's like, what? But yeah, Jeremy Renner, we are introduced to, and I just, you know, Jeremy Renner store, Jeremy Renner app, Jeremy Renner, blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
Not Jeremy Renner fan.
He's just being, you know, funny Jeremy Renner in an action movie. I enjoy him.
He's fine here, I guess.
Is he the new focus of your ire from Tom Cruise in this movie?
He's like, if you were cloning Tom Cruise and then you didn't finish the cloning process and you just kind of scraped down the tank and then you mounded that into a person.
Time and resources.
Yeah. Then you just get Jeremy Renner. And there's just an incredible phoniness to Jeremy Renner that I don't enjoy, which has persisted for several years in his role as Hawkeye. But whatever. It's fine. He's fine here. The comedy stuff he gets to do, he does okay. He's just a weird person. Like when you used
a gif of him to announce that we're doing the thing. The next time I get to seduce the rich guy.
Yeah, because that was a funny line in the movie. But he has a storefront on Amazon where you can buy stuff to look like the rugged Jeremy Renner. He has a music career. Where he uses his vocals to sing about cars, apparently. He had an app until it was shut down because they couldn't control the trolling, because you could send messages and make it look like it came from Jeremy Renner. I didn't really think that went through. He's an odd duck. You might like him, but he is an odd duck. Like there is some stuff going on with Jeremy Renner.
Some would even say that we ourselves are odd ducks, Joe.
Mm. Well, that's fine. Ducks are the best. Mighty Ducks forever.
Ducks don't wear underwear.
So they have the introduction of Jeremy Renner and Tom Wilkinson. And Tom Wilkinson is like, yes, so you were really after Cobalt because of this reason that was this thing that was that thing. And I can't tell you this thing, but here's a USB drive that I certainly couldn't give you. And I certainly can't tell you to go do this other thing. And then their car is shot at and Tom Wilkinson gets a headshot and he's dead. And then the veers off the bridge into the water. And this is how you knew you were in Prague, because this was totally a Prague bridge. And you see the car going under and Jeremy Renner's inside and Tom Cruise is like, I'm going to go outside and see if they could help. And there's just all this machine gun fire. And then he comes back in and there's a thing where they're going to distract them by strapping a flare to Tom Wilkinson's body and then flinging him through the water.
I thought it was the driver's body, just out of respect.
Yeah. Just the driver's body.
dead, but you know, you don't want to throw your boss down the river.
No. Be loyal to your class. Throw everyone in the service industry downstream. But the
gig economy will do to you.
Yeah. Oh man. And so everybody's shooting their machine gun stuff at the flare, allowing Jeremy Renner and Tom Cruise to escape, and they get out of there. And then Sidorov comes by and he says, "What are you doing? Stop!" And it's just like, "Wait a minute. Hold the phone." Like, you authorize them to, like, blow up everything? Like, how does that normal? That is bananas. But they get out of there, and they have the information to go to the sort of safe house place that'll have, like, supplies and stuff from Tom Wilkinson before he died. And so they go there, and it's a train yard, and they have this gag of running to catch up to the train to use the optical eye scanner thing without running into a post so that they can get on board, and they get inside.
That was a lot.
Yeah, it was a little too much, because you get on board and then the lights turn on and it reveals that Simon Pegg and Paula Patton were already there, and it's just like, you guys could open the door for them, but it was, there were like had the lights on inside. I don't know. It's just weird. But anyway, they're all on board now. And then all of a sudden, Ethan Hunt goes from knowing nothing and receiving a USB drive to being the person who puts on a USB drive and then puts a USB drive on top of a tabletop, and then starts explaining everything in the PowerPoint presentation that presumably Tom Wilkinson had assembled, because it wasn't Ethan that did it. And so he goes through all of the little bits and pieces of facts that up till now only Tom Wilkinson knew, apparently. But now the spirit of Tom Wilkinson is speaking through Ethan Hunt, because all of a sudden Ethan knows it.
Whatever, they do their research, and this is they put together the plan.
And the reason the movie is called Ghost Protocol is because the IMF has been disavowed the whole entire thing, because they think they bombed the Kremlin, so everybody's out of it, and they're all recalled. But that was the whole thing with Ethan going to do this thing, because this is the last cache of IMF stuff, and they can still go do the mission.
I think they did a pretty good job between the whole killing the secretary scene and this scene of basically saying, like, stuff's serious right now, like, everything is haywire, and politically everyone just kind of needs to, like, disavow and lay low, but nuclear war is coming, and we really need to get on our game and go fix this immediately. Otherwise, it's going to get so much worse, and it does continue to just get worse and worse and worse right up until the last possible second. But I like the way they did it in this movie.
Yeah, but they reveal that the analyst, Jeremy Renner, is there, and he's being all analysty, but they reveal that they got to go to Dubai and they have all this stuff, so they got to go do it. And so they grab everything they can and they start to assemble things so that they can make a plan. And there's a whole thing of, like, you know, you can't go after Sabine Moreau's character, because Paul Patton has beef with her because she killed Josh Holloway's Trevor Hanaway character. Guess they tried, but you know, they gotta go do their thing, and it's like, okay fine, you gotta go to Dubai. Cut to Dubai, cars driving around.
There's a trick where they're gonna steal the launch codes, feed them fake launch codes, and then they will have averted nuclear crisis, and then they'll track the guy down and arrest him or whatever.
Yeah, and
which is the beginning of the plan, which is a good plan.
Yeah, but their plan is that they're going to duplicate the floors of the building in the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building, and that will fool Sophie Moreau and Wistrom. Okay, so Wistrom, they're going to fool them, so they think that they met and they handed each other the things that they were supposed to hand them, but they didn't, and that those things were instead handed off to somebody else. So Jeremy Renner is going to act as the nuclear code guy, analyst person. And he gets these contacts, which have a computer uplink thingy majig. And, what it's supposed to do is reproduce the text and, presumably colorful illustrations, but not, the numbers in the exact order that they originally appeared, so that the codes would be useless. But they don't know that the real analyst is going to be there, and it's going to foil their plans, so they can't give them the scrambled codes. So then there's an argument that occurs between Jeremy Renner and Tom Cruise, where it's just like, well, you know, we can't do that, because then we're going to be giving, like, real nuclear codes to this person. Like, it's not worth it. Like, we just got to bust these people. And Tom Cruise is like, no, but yeah, take them down for the larger part of the mission. Like, you know, they're just like two little crooks, but you know, they're going to, you know, if you don't take down everything, like, they're going to, you know, just go blow up everything again. So blah, 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 blah. And this, talks Jeremy Renner into doing it. He's along for it at that point, but the plan is still a little haywire, because, Paul Patton is going to double as Sophie Moreau, and Tom Cruise is going to double as Wistrom, and they're going to do their mask printing thing, and they break out the mask printing case, and it has a little bit of an upgrade from the previous movie, except the part where it breaks, which is kind of funny, because it's just like spraying makeup, face paint stuff all over. Mm-hmm. But Simon Pegg is like, oh, I can't break into the thing, and I could just call up somebody, but, you know, the IMF disavowed, so I can't, I just don't want to call. We're going to have to actually physically connect to this server in order to do this stuff and get control of the elevators. And Tom Cruise is like, yeah, well, yeah, whatever. Like, what's that? What does that mean? Just, like, just hack the thing. And he's like, well, I can't. You're going to have to physically do it. You're going to have to go to the room from the outside of the building. And so this gives us the iconic scene of Tom Cruise going on the outside of the Burj Khalifa up the whole thingy majig. I think they're on. I think they're supposed to be on floor 100 and going to 113. Is that right?
He says it's like 11 up and 6 to the side or whatever, or something like that.
Anyway, but the floors that they're actually manipulating are 118 and 119. But there's a lot of tension here because Tom Cruise has to use these gecko gloves, which are gloves that apparently are supposed to have little fibers that are electrically stimulated to stick out like a gecko and then like adhere to things. And it's that electrical charge that allows them to operate. It's a stretch, but you know, what in a Mission Impossible movie isn't?
Mm-hmm.
I do like how clearly they communicate whether or not the glove is operational. Because there's a light on it and a noise, and the glove has these little triangles that glow, and blue is glue and red is dead, which is very easy to remember.
They didn't go with green and red like the gum from the first movie, which seems like a missed opportunity.
Well, you don't want to combine green and red because then you're dead. Tom Cruise is going up the side of the building. One of the gloves fails. He flings it off in frustration. It sticks to the building. I love the scenes with the glove just floating around. Tom Cruise gets up there. He tries to cut through the glass. The thing like fritzes and has a little bit of a power burst. He drops down the side of the building, catches himself with the one good glove that he still has. Gets back up there, then flings himself against the glass by sort of gripping on and repeatedly flinging himself back and forth until he gets inside, putting in the override, not being able to go downstairs, having to go back out through the building, but his other glove had failed, and so he flings a cable thing down the side, and then he's swinging around, and he can't quite reach the other side, and Jeremy Renner says, your line is too short. And Tom Cruise gives a very good line reading of no shit. Then he flings himself by running backwards and forwards again towards the thing, and he gets there. So
he gets real close too. He was a little conservative with his jump, and he hit the top lip of the window and knocks himself backwards in a little backflip and then almost eats it. But Jeremy Renner dives out the window and grabs him by the foot, and then Paula Patton grabs him by the foot so they don't fall. And luckily they are able to slowly pull themselves back in rather than falling off the side of this giant building, which is, God, it's like crazy looking straight down from that camera.
Yeah, I mean, your brain just almost can't process the height of this building. But they pull him in, and then they're like, okay, time to put on our masks and get going. And then the mask thing's not working. And so they're just like, okay.
They probably haven't met in person before, so we'll go with that. And they're like, probably, really? It's like, well, what other option do we have? Nothing else, so let's go for it.
And so we get Tom Cruise pretending to be Wistrom and Jeremy Renner pretending to be the nuclear code guy. And you get Paula Patton pretending to be Sophie Moreau. And so they operate in these two matching suites, and we're going back and forth between them. And there's some tension because Sophie expects her diamonds in payment for delivering these codes. The bad guy expects the codes in terms of diamonds, but there's a clever little sleight of hand thing that goes on with Simon Pegg where he transports the things, and Jeremy Renner is able to look at the codes fast enough for them to print into paper that is irradiated or something, somehow electrically tagged, RF tagged or something, so that it can be homed within, what is it, 25 yards, 25 meters, something like that.
He said half a mile, actually, but you know, the sandstorm probably reduces that range a little bit.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's not going to come up. It does, because immediately after this transaction, things go south because Sophie Moreau realizes that there's something in Jeremy Renner's eye, and there's a gunfight, and then the nuclear code guy is shot, and all kinds of heck breaks loose. The Westrom breaks to the elevator, gets downstairs, but they try to slow him down. Tom Cruise is right behind him. Then Sidorov is there and stops him and distracts him from getting Wistrom. Then they go out into the sandstorm that had been forecast earlier, literally. And they're running through the streets and they can't see anything. It's just all covered in sand. But then Tom Cruise remembers that he has his climbing goggles, so he puts this back on. And then
they're like sick Oakley squash goggles.
And so then they cover their mouths with some cloth they stole off of some line somewhere. And they're running through the streets. They get into several, there's a vehicle thing. And at one point, Tom Cruise gets on top, peels off part of the face, and it reveals that it's actually the wacko Swedish scientist who wants to kill everybody, who had been impersonating Wistrom. So if they had given him the wrong codes, they could have caught all of them. But they didn't know that he would be wearing a mask because masks are...
What did you think of that? That weird turn that, what's his name? Hendrix was pretending to be Wistrom for some reason.
I felt it was completely unnecessary, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't feel like it delivers a payoff other than you feel like, well, we shouldn't have given him the code. And it's like, but that's not really the moral of this story, you know?
And I guess technically what it does is it finally puts Hendrix face to face with Ethan. So like Hendrix knows who's coming after him. So like previously he saw Ethan in his like fake Russian nose and mustache. So he didn't necessarily know
who
he was up against.
That Russian general looked very different from Ethan Hunt.
Right. But like now he knows exactly like what to look out for. When he's doing his thing,
I guess. But
I think that could be the only rationale for like why he would go through this.
Yeah.
Or what the benefit would be.
Yeah. So Ethan Hunt and everybody regroups and there's a lot of, you know, wound licking that's occurring. Jeremy Renner is shouting about how, he was assigned to protect these people in Croatia. And then the Serbian guys killed the wife when the husband went up for a jog and they killed the agents. And so they got back and there was just nothing he could do about it. And he couldn't say anything, but then he never saw that guy again until Ethan Hunt stepped into the car. And then he realized it was the same guy. And so he feels like he killed Ethan Hunt's wife through his thing. And that's why he's an analyst instead of an agent now. And then Ethan Hunt's all like, I can't rely on any of you people to act as a team because, you know, you kicked Sophie Moreau out of the building.
Fair point, right? Like, the mission was to go get these papers and you guys were doing other stuff. It's like, I'm the only one that's, you know, ran out of the building and tried to go get the guy. Like, what the hell were the rest of you guys doing? Yeah, the scientist guy's dead in the hall and then you threw Sophie out the window, but like, hello, teamwork, like, help me out here. The codes are out here.
Yeah, the truth is out there. But Ethan has his own...
The truth is in the cloud.
Ethan has his own ulterior plan where he's been messaging somebody, and so he goes to these docks, and he meets the long blonde-haired guy from the first movie who has the mask from the first movie, and gets the mask, and then he's inside of the bay of this ship where there's several large shipping containers, and also... the escaped Russian prisoner guy from the beginning of the movie who says, hey, look, the thing, yay, we're all friends. And then he leaves. And Ethan talks to the Fog, the arms dealer guy, and he's like, hey, look, so nuclear war is bad for business, so we can come to some sort of agreement because you don't want that to happen. And then he's like, well, I can't help you, but I certainly can help you by telling you that, you know, in Mumbai, there's a guy who bought an old Russian military satellite and repurposed it as part of his communications network. And so he's like, oh, okay, so we got to go do that. And so then he's like...
The second conversation that didn't actually happen because I can't actually tell you these things, which is, you know...
It's a little strange.
One might have been enough for that joke, but it's fine.
Yeah. But... they meet at the airport at Dubai with the team because, as foretold, he needs a team, and so he must get the only team he can get, and that is Paul Patton, Jeremy Renner, and Simon Pegg, who are back together. And there's a private plane there, and apparently that's Tom Cruise's private plane in real life.
Is that so?
Yeah. And in the background, there's another plane, and that's one of the producers on the movie's plane.
Hmm.
Mm.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Money.
I want a plane. I want a plane.
I don't want a plane. That's very expensive.
I can run really fast in dress shoes if I get a plane.
I don't think so, Dad. I need you to send me a reel of you attempting to run as fast as Tom Cruise towards camera.
Well, that's the thing. He's not running as fast as you think he is. He looks like he's running really fast. It's a movie run.
Ah, according to Brad Bird, he's running very fast, and it's not a movie run. He goes all out whenever he runs.
I mean, compared to the way other people run in movies, yes, he is running quickly, but he's not Usain Bolt up there with his dress shoes and a suit on.
Okay. Well, I mean, his legs are a little shorter than Usain Bolt. So anyway.
His body is shorter than Usain Bolt's legs.
A little bit. But so anyway, they pile onto the thing and they're going to go to Mumbai and they're going to crash this party and get this information that they need from the magnate who owns this telecom network. And Paul Patton is enlisted to use her feminine wiles to procure this information. And meanwhile, Simon Pegg and Jeremy Renner are talking about their little magnet chainmail suit with their little robot guy and how they're going to use that to get Jeremy Renner into the super secret server thing so they could change the chip thing, but they can't do that until they get inside the building, and so there's some stuff, shenanigans that happen, and apparently this was some hotel that wasn't open yet in Dubai, which they decided to use as their location, which you can, I guess, kind of tell from the way the opening is shot, where it kind of looks like you're looking at a matte painting, because maybe it is, but they have everybody go inside, and the interior of the space is full of people, and they're all talking and stuff, and they're milling around, and there's a lot of, like, get that guy interested in you stuff, and Ethan's trying to coordinate, and Sidorov is there because he'd been tipped off by the arms dealer guy, and so they're all milling about through the place, and eventually they get the... We get Jeremy Renner doing sort of what you kind of saw in Mission Impossible 1, where he goes into a shaft and he jumps through the shaft and then he's hanging in the air above something treacherous. Only this time it's an enormous metal spinning fan, which looks like, you know, an enormous Vitamix, I guess.
It's an unusual design for a fan. It looks very menacing.
Very menacing, but he's fine.
Although it would prevent you from diving into it, presumably, if you didn't have a little robot with a magnet on it.
Yeah, and so then the robot with the magnet drives him over to this corridor, and everything's hot because the server is hot because it's not being cooled by that fan. So he's trying to, like, get to the spot where they need to put in the thing. Meanwhile, bad guys are arriving at the satellite command headquarters, and they shoot everybody, and then they use their suitcase to override the thingy and upload the virus to the satellite, and that locks them out of being able to do the thing that they were planning on doing from there. So the code that they got from the guy, from seducing this guy, is useless because they can't upload it from there anymore, and they got to go to the site where they did the thing. So then they all hop out of there. Tom Cruise and Paul Patton go into his BMW i8 and try to drive as fast as possible across Mumbai, which is, of course, as we've said, Abu Dhabi. Sorry, not Abu Dhabi.
Prague?
No.
Dubai. Yes.
And so they drive through Dubai, which is supposed to be Mumbai, and they get to the thing just as the other guys are leaving, and then the other guys are...
Yeah, very reasonably, like, they're stuck in traffic, and as has been the case with the rest of the movie, they are behind and losing, and they're trying to get there to stop the guy from launching the missile since he circumvented their server plan, but they don't get there in time, and he literally fires off a nuclear missile. Like, they missed that part, and they're just kind of sitting there sad, and Tom Cruise is just like, got to be a way to shut it off, so I guess we'll keep going. Plan F now, maybe. We'll just, we keep going until we're all dead, so that's just what we do, because it's an impossible mission.
Force. So they arrive at the building just in time to see Michael Nyquist and the other guy. They split up. The other guy goes back inside the building to sabotage the broadcast equipment while Michael Nyquist is running away with the silver briefcase full of remote stuff, which is apparently linked to the broadcast equipment there. So Tom Cruise goes
pretty
after...
good Wi-Fi signal on that suitcase, too.
Yeah. So Tom Cruise goes after that guy, and Paul Patton goes after the henchman. And so there's a gunfire exchange, but not before he manages to pull several things inside of the building and damage some stuff. And he goes around a building. He goes around the corner of a server thing, and she goes after him, but he's disappeared, and only his gun is remaining, which means he died and disintegrated into the Force. But then Jeremy Renner and Simon Pegg arrive, and they're like, oh no, it's all broken. Well, I can fix it. And then the power goes out, and they're like, uh-oh, I'm gonna need power. And then Paul Patton's like, I'm gonna go after him. And she's like, uh-oh, I was shot, and I'm not feeling so great. And then Jeremy Renner's like, I'm gonna go after him. You look after Simon Pegg while he does the thing.
This is like Chris Farley on Saturday Night Live when he describes things to people. I enjoy your enthusiasm, but it's good. It's good. It's a good scene. There's you got your fighting action. You got your suspense action. You got your chasing your suitcase action. It's all intercut back and forth. And this is, of course, the car park scene where it's a little goofy at this point that Ethan is actually in like a physical altercation with Hendrix, because he's Ethan Hunt and this guy is not Ethan Hunt. So you would think Ethan Hunt would just like hit him in the throat one time and he would go down. But you know, Ethan's beat up or whatever, and then he gets his, like, he falls a couple of times in this car park and gets hurt, and then his leg gets run over by a car or whatever. So maybe that sort of like levels the playing field. But there's this very crazily choreographed scene where they're throwing the briefcase all around and going up and down and falling on cars and grabbing on things and fighting each other, and it's very well done. Right up into the point where Hendrix basically says, like, I am willing to do whatever it takes to beat you in this, and I know the timer is running out here, so I'm just going to grab this suitcase and dive, like, face first 12 stories down and just, like, kill myself just so that the suitcase is far enough away from you that you can't do anything about it, which is pretty bold plan for a bad guy.
Yeah, I got to say, like, he's really committed to this as a person who is nuts. But it's... I agree with you. I thought it was weird, especially the outset of the fight, how skilled Michael Nyquist's nuclear scientist wacko character was at
combat. He lands
combat.
A couple of punches that are pretty serious to Tom Cruise.
It seemed implausible up until the point where Tom Cruise jumps off the side of the thing to go into the convertible and try to retrieve the suitcase, and then the robot thing spins or pivots the car a little too soon, and so he hits the side of the car. Like, just watching that, you feel it, and you're just like, ow, like that was devastating. And so you start to feel like, at that point, okay, so sure, he leaped off the side of a thing, fell about two to three stories, and smashed his face into the side of a car. Like, I can understand how that would level the playing field, but prior to that, it didn't really make any sense how they were, like, just sort of evenly matched. It just didn't ring true to me.
Maybe he's just really into cardio too, and he's fast, and he outran Ethan also.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe he's also a health nut. But they After that extreme thing of him gripping the suitcase and jumping over and falling on the ground, and you see his leg twitching, Ethan is like, well, I gotta get down there. So he gets into a car and then he drives down, sort of, he realizes the airbag to save him, and then he crawls out of there, opens up the box, and he says, mission accomplished, and pushes down on the big red button and doesn't do nothing, because mission is not accomplished, and that was just funny. But Jeremy Renner's fighting the guy to turn on the power, and then Simon Pegg shows up and shoots the guy, and then Jeremy Renner is able to turn the power back on, which lets Paul Patton put the hard drive back in, which I don't know how that's why that needed to, I don't understand that, but then
very quickly too,
yeah, and then Tom Cruise is then able to push the plunger again, and it actually stops the time. The missile shuts off just as it sort of glances against the very tippy top of the Transamerica building, and then falls into the San Francisco Bay, right near the Embarcadero, but you know, the day is saved. They have defeated this missile situation. Everybody's not going to die in a nuclear winter, but yay.
Yeah, they and as noted in the Toddcast, if you're watching very carefully, when he finally does hit that button and it stopped, the last frame of time you see on the screen is 1 second and 1.13 seconds or whatever.
Yeah, but so the day is saved. And then
Cutting it close.
Sidorov shows up with all of his Russian special forces guys and sees Tom Cruise, and they move the case out of the way. And then they're like, Sidorov says, you really were on our side. And he's like, yeah. And he's not really talking. He's just like, uh-huh. And Sidorov says, hospital. And he's like, yes. Yeah. He's not feeling well. Cut to Vancouver. Sorry, Seattle. And so we have everybody at a fish shack, on the water, and
drinking beers, hanging out.
Yeah. And Ving Rhames is there and he's talking about his thing. And then he gets up to leave cause he's got to finish up with his stuff. It's a very brief cameo for him. And, we've got, the reintroduction of Paul Patton, Jeremy Renner and Simon Pegg. And they're all given their iPhone 5S's or whatever, iPhone 5s.
Fours.
Anyway, they're giving
sure
phones. And they're told they're on his special team thing now. And then there's this drawn out thing with Jeremy Renner where he says that he can't be on the team because there's nothing. They haven't resolved the whole thing with his wife and his guilt around that. And then Ethan Hunt is just sitting there smiling and he just says, oh, yeah, well, what if she told you she wasn't dead? So everything's fine. It was all part of a mission. So
yeah, I knew you guys were my security, and I played you because no one was allowed to know that she's alive.
Yeah, and so then, Jeremy Renner's like, "Oh, that makes me feel so much better," and so then he leaves. And then Tom Cruise has some meaningful glances at Michelle Monaghan, who has arrived at a store across from them, and she glances back as she enters and presumably does a transaction in the store. That lets you know that everything's a-okay.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it's sad that you can tell, like, he can't be married anymore because he's just too... He's Ethan Hunt, and no one will ever be safe when they're with him.
Yeah. Well, I believe I said something to the effect of that last time when we did... three, that either he was not going to be with her anymore or she was going to die. And we got the not going to be with her anymore. But maybe she'll come back and then die in one of the other ones. Who knows?
I wonder if she will come back again.
Yeah. Who could say? We will find out. I've been very intentionally not looking at the cast lists for upcoming Mission Impossible episodes because I kind of want to find out. And I kind of feel like she is going to come back, and I kind of feel like I'm going to be disappointed. But we'll see. Maybe I'll really like it.
I appreciate that you're doing a vague attempt at a full media brownout. for a movie from 8 years ago.
Please, partial media brownout.
Partial media brownout. You're not even fully brown.
No. No, but see that was I've said this joke to Todd before when we were talking about he's got his full media blackout thing, and I'm like, well, I watched some trailers or whatever, but then I'm like, oh, I'm okay with it, so I'll watch it. And so it's not a full media blackout, like I don't like cover my eyes and run screaming from movie posters or anything. But there's a, you know, an element of I don't go seeking out additional stuff. I'm not on Dark Horizons or Ain't It Cool News or anything. Like I'm satisfied with the information that I have.
Is Ain't It Cool News still a thing?
I have no idea. No one Google that.
You just made yourself sound really old if it's not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dan, I don't know how to I'll tell you this, but I'm...
No, don't say it.
I'm an old man.
Yeah, me too.
I'm going to be 37 this year.
Yikes. Yikes.
Well, on that note of mortality, I hope it makes you feel better that Tom Cruise is like, I don't know, 60 and jumping off buildings.
Look what he's doing. Yeah, he's flying around off the Burj Khalifa, and he was, what, in his late 40s, early 50s still?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Someday I'm going to get in shape, and I'm going to go do that too.
Someday you're going to get in shape, fling yourself off the Burj Khalifa.
Yeah, you'll see the headlines, man dies flinging himself off Burj Khalifa.
Well, there's one thing you can do, and that's wear the shiny suits that Jeremy Renner wears. So you can accomplish that.
See, I will have to get into Tom Cruise fighting shape before my shiny suit fits me again.
Oh, shiny suits. You just have the one, right?
I just have the one, yes. I will become an Impossible Mission Force person and travel the world. I will put my shiny suit on, and I will travel back to Vietnam, and I will go visit the lady who made it for me while laughing and shaking her head at me the whole time. She was very kind.
That's funny. All right, so on that note.
Mission accomplished.
Dun, 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 dun. Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun. Good work.
Yeah. I'm no Michael Giacchino, so, yeah, whatever.
It's true. Your name is not Michael Giacchino.